Today's program has been brought to you by our good friends at the Heritage Meat Shop. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.com.
Pate, best merguez ever, pastrami, andouille, hickory smoked bacon, Irish bangers, and maple glazed smoked ham. Welcome to Meet Your Maker on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Rachel Wharton. Our guest today is the maker of those things I just described. He's a charcuterer, maker of sausages and smoked delights. It's Scott Breedy, who's the founder of Brooklyn Cured. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here, Rachel.
Also in-house today, we have the director of this very radio station, who taught Aaron Fairbanks, who taught Scott. You taught Scott how to be the art of charcuterie.
I gave him some foundational information, but he has since far surpassed his teacher.
I guess we should go back in time tell everyone where you met and where you both learned how to do this in the first place.
Aaron and I met at Gramercy Tavern, where we were both line cooks, some years ago, 2007 or 8.
Yeah, I'm not good with dates.
The historical details will be muted to protect the innocent.
Yeah, no, I would like stare at Scotty across. He was way ahead of me in the line cooking department, so I looked up to him in many ways. And Mike Anthony, who's a chef at Gramercy Tavern, was interested in developing some in-house charcuterie. And I had expressed some interest in that after experimenting a little bit under Matt Weingarten when I was working at Savoy. And so sat down with Mike, and we put together a list of a lot of the similar things to what you just mentioned. And I just kind of went at it, looking to really loosely develop some recipes and some techniques, look at the ordering process. And I did that for about 4 months, 5 months. And then as things go in the kitchen, it was time to move on to a new position. And Scotty, I don't know how you fell into, like, why did you start?
I expressed interest in working with you because
you were working the line then as well.
I was a line cook there for 2 years, and I had worked virtually every station in the kitchen. So I expressed to Nick Anderer, who was our executive sous chef at the time, I'm like, hey Nick, I would love to work with Aaron on this stuff. It's something new and it's fresh and exciting. So Nick was like, yeah, sure. But I didn't try to take your job away.
No, not taking my... No, I just couldn't remember. I knew I was kind of like, oh, I'm ready to like do something else, go back on the line.
Absolutely.
One point I think we should be sure to make is that it isn't like you guys are like, I think I'd like to join the salad station. What you were doing is something that five restaurants around the country, you know, probably more than that, 15 were doing at the time. It was like it's an old art that you're basically having to, like, you were relearning how it would take. I don't even know if it was ever actually even part of restaurants in the United States,
I don't know either. I mean, I guess historically, I mean, I associate charcuterie with older parts of the world than the U.S. Although I think, I don't know, Scott, you knew, are there like classic American charcuterie? I'm thinking of like, you know, Sam Edwards, like American style, like the Virginia country hams.
Definitely. In terms of American style charcuterie, that's like down south, I think those country hams are a hallmark of charcuterie in this country. But you're right, there's not such a distinct tradition that's embedded into our food culture, but it's certainly
things have changed. Some listeners may not even know what we mean when we say charcuterie. Maybe you guys should define it for me.
Sure. Charcuterie is a French word that not literally translated, but it's derived from the two words that mean cooked meat, and I will not even venture to pronounce them. But it is cooking meat. The craft itself is focused on meat preservation. So it's many country families who raise their own animals would find ways in which to preserve meat so that they could feed themselves and their families and their friends for the entire year. Part of that preservation comes from dry cured meats like prosciutto, and certainly smoked meats like bacon. and also something as simple as a fresh sausage, like an Italian sausage.
Yeah, I would think, and thinking just back for a second on the American tradition, I know if you read like The Little House on the Prairie, Laura Ingalls Wilder's, there's like a wonderful description of kind of the family hog slaughter, and then how, because as a family of four or five, you're not going to go through a whole 200-pound hog before the meat would spoil. So you look at different preservation techniques, which might include like boiling, you know, cooking things gently in their own fat, or other kind of salting or curing methods.
Do you remember when you two were learning how to, what was like the first book that you read, or like what is the first thing you have to master if you're going to cure meat? And then you, Scott, you also make lots and lots of fresh sausages, but I think, but you also cure, which is its own, which is like kind of like a scientific art and skill and an art.
A craft,
yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for putting those two together and equaling one word.
It's certainly all of those things. When we first started out, we were very excited by the newness of it all. And that kitchen was had a lot of very talented and great individuals in it. So we drew upon their knowledge of food. None of us had a really strong knowledge of making charcuterie, but we were all analytical people who really knew about taste and flavor and just making good food. So we had that going for us, but the reference books we used are pretty much the ones that had that have become the touchstones. Paul Bertoli's Cooking by Hand and Michael Ruhlman's Charcuterie, which are stunning books. And if anyone out there is interested, I would recommend them to this day.
Yeah, those are the same books that I think I looked to and recommended to Scotty. I mean, there's some older kind of country, like if you look back to like the blue, like the Ball Blue Book of canning, there's some kind of crossover there with regards to preservation techniques. But I think one of the most exciting things that Gramercy Tavern really provided for us was just this opportunity to practice, to kind of indulge our curiosities. I mean, I would say one of the things that was frustrating for me, because not only was I new to charcuterie, but I was also new to cooking. So it was weird to look around in the kitchen and realize essentially that nobody knew more about making charcuterie than I did. while they may have better palates and way more cooking experience and in many cases probably better instincts, like that was this kind of exciting way to tuck into something new and something I did for a really short time. So I think that's the other big thing about charcuterie is time is often one of the biggest ingredients.
Right. When you make a fresh sausage, do you have to let a fresh sausage cure?
Not technically, just just seasoning the ground meat and stuffing it into casings is essentially the process.
So I could eat it right away.
You could totally eat it right away. You might want to cook it unless you're in Florence and then serving like a raw sausage patty, which is
or in Brah. Oh my god,
awesome.
The amazing Brah raw sausage, which is part of Italy. But so, I mean, one of the things that's very difficult is when you set out to learn this craft, is that it takes time to figure out if you've like royally screwed it up or not, right? So, do you remember the first thing you tried, you guys made, or Scott, or you remember the first thing that you'd attempted?
Like a
prosciutto?
The prosciuttos we made actually initially came out very well, but the dry cured sausages were very, very challenging. I think still to this day, they're the most difficult thing to make very well, and I think a lot of that has to do with the air introduced into the... The ground meat, when it's stuffed into the casing, has air pockets, so it's like difficult to manage that and really like nail that aspect of making it. So, and especially at first, I struggled with making dry cured sausages at Gramercy.
And what are the elements that you're working with? It's air and temperature and humidity. That's how you manage what you're applying to these things?
Those are essentially the most critical elements of making really good dry cured meats. And managing them was new, but because of the experience in the kitchen, like, I mean, cooking a piece of meat or fish is very different, but you still have to manage time and temperature. Mm-hmm. So those two elements are kind of a constant, but like humidity and airflow for dry cured meats is certainly something that you have to pay attention to and that are variable. So you have to like like keep a close eye on everything and like check your dry cured meats.
So how do you literally do that? You just like set up a fan in the corner of a walk-in?
Well, I would say just to backtrack for a second, one of the things that makes Scotty so much better suited to this position than I ever was is he is incredibly organized and kind of diligent at, you know, making recordings. Essentially, note-taking. Because if you're putting together a dry cured sausage that's going to hang for a month, 2 months, 6 months, you know, you're not going to remember what was happening that day, anything that may have of affected things, like how long did it sit out before I stuffed it, how did it look to me when I went to hang it, and right. and
when
kind
did
of
that
keeping
mold
those
form?
Notes well yeah exactly and then kind of just keep, you know, I think a big part of the initial learning process is keeping an eye on things. And you have a sense from eating wonderful dry-cured meats and other preserved products, like what they're supposed to look like. But I think, you know, the first time you see, like, white mold all over something, or your, like, big plump sausage get, like, tiny and shriveled, it's, like, exciting and scary.
No, absolutely. I do think that paying close attention and analyzing variables is the heart at what could make someone really good at making this category of foods and at this craft. I guess that's true of a lot of things, but especially because the variables are changing all the time. You might get a pork shoulder from a pig that is leaner this week than it was last week, or you might just have ambient temperature issues, especially in New York City, where the climate is changing all the time, even week to week. So, like, if you're just, like, noticing and maybe even talking to someone about what's going on, it helps you, like, figure out what those variables are and how to correct for them in the future.
And also, well, I mean, over time, you now have your own space. So you can, before you're working at maybe a restaurant kitchen or some borrowed kitchen space where you're working around what people are doing otherwise. So now is everything very, can you guarantee that your dried, whatever, soppressata or whatever it may be, is going to be consistent, or is its variability part of it? Or you consider it part of your sausage's charm?
I would like to say that our sausage is charming no matter what.
agreed.
But I would also like to say that because we do this all the time, I don't think I would have gone into business making specific products if I thought they would be different each time.
Right.
So those variables that I'm discussing are the core of what we're managing and looking at and adjusting for. I think really good cooks adjust all the time, and that's essentially what we're doing in the kitchen, you know. And you almost have to in any food service setting just adjust, whether you're doing a catering event like offsite, or whether you're like just cooking at home, or whether you're cooking in a restaurant, or whether you're curing meats or making charcuterie.
And how do you do that on the fly when you've got like 15 moldy hanging, like, sausages swinging?
I think it might be easier to talk about if you talk about like the process of actually stuffing sausage into a casing, and you think about like what are the concerns there, and like what are you shooting for, and how are you adjusting at that point?
Like pH factor.
Well, less than that, I think even it's like some sausages have more liquid in them, so they're kind of wetter or stickier, and some are drier, and how cold are they staying? Right. You know, do I need to pop it back in the cooler for a second? Because, you know, I mean, Scotty...
Like the way you're making a pie crust, even.
Exactly.
Right. Oh, interesting.
So you're reacting to those things, or in the casings, you're using natural casings, so sometimes they're a little bigger, or they're balloons
yes.
that change. You know, you know, there's some that are extra strength, and some are super sensitive. And
I knew we'd get to something, we'd probably bring that in. I knew that would come up at some point. That's what she said.
Certainly these are things to look out for, especially when you're making fresh sausage and dealing with different types of meat. Because the moisture content of poultry is greater than the moisture content of pork, and the moisture content of pork is greater than the moisture content of lamb. So it's you're always adjusting for that. Usually if there's more fat, there's less moisture in the mix. But you want to keep your ratios of protein to fat in every sausage mix like pretty tight and consistent. And those meats that tend to have more moisture in them require less liquid added to the mix in order to get a really like awesome emulsified consistency. And that's just something like that we do over time and keep changing and adjusting for based on the different types of meat that we get.
I remember interviewing you, Scott, a long time ago, and you said, this is when you had just started Brooklyn Cured, probably maybe like a year or almost 2 years ago, and you said when you started doing this at Gramercy Tavern, you were just like, this is it. This is what I'm meant to do.
That's actually not what he first said.
Sure. But I remember distinctly you telling me that. What did he first say?
I was coloring perception for the media's benefit. That's what I was doing.
But I was curious whether it's because it's like you can combine like creativity with like this wonky precision, with note taking, with being a scientist. It's like these two things come together with charcuterie.
Absolutely. Like I feel like all of these qualities speak to some amount of geekiness, which don't really reflect my personality, but like it's all sort of true. For the most part, I really did fall for this category of food and making it, you know, I just fell for the craft. For lots of reasons, like I felt as though it took like a little bit more thought, which maybe is incorrect, but to me it felt that way. It felt a little bit more analytical and fun. It was also utilizing components of carcasses, I guess. It was utilizing cuts of meat that aren't really celebrated. Like, people want pork chops and steaks. Anybody can cut one, you know? So, and anybody can sell one. There's varying degrees of quality, of course, but not everyone is going to utilize a pork liver or even a pork shoulder and turn it into something that's super desirable and different and has elements of taste and flavor and balance that that you can't just get anywhere, you know? So, like, that's really, those are all the components that really, like, I fell for. Like, applying what I knew about taste, like, this awesome, like, craft, and, like, I felt like, just like Aaron said, I was doing something that not too many people know how to do. This is awesome. That's part of what I fell for, too. Like, being, like, distinct, honestly. And just, like, the end results are awesome. Like, prosciutto, like, hot dogs, pastrami, like, these things are dope. Like, they're out of control. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, it was frustrating certainly in the beginning to learn and struggle, as it is in anything, but it's ultimately like so awesome.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to hear more about each and every one of those products. This is Meet Your Maker on Heritage Radio Network. We're talking to Brooklyn Cured.
Following is a message from the Heritage Meat Shop.
Are you tired of just hearing buzzwords? Do you want to actually take part in the food revolution? Then come on down to the Heritage Meat Shop, located in New York's historic Essex Street Market, on the corner of Essex and Delancey. We have rare breed pork, beef, poultry, lamb, and goat, not to mention charcuterie that'll make you squeal. All raised right, by the right people, so you know they'll taste right. Try the meat that over 100 New York chefs ache for. Come to the Heritage Meat Shop and pick up some revolution today.
For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
This is Rachel Wharton this is Meet Your Maker on Heritage Radio Network, and we are talking to Scott Bridie, the founder of Brooklyn Cured. Before the break, you were listing off all of the great products that you make, and you are a Brooklyn native, and I think an Italian American, grew up in Bensonhurst, but you specifically decided that your company would make cured products from all over the world. Why did you want to do that?
Well, I didn't want to limit our scope. I enjoy making things from various regions, various countries. It just gave us like the opportunity to connect with many different types of people. I think that New York City is amazing in and of itself, but also so many people come here from everywhere in the world to live and settle. So why not have some English bangers for some folks who are living uptown and raising kids here, and that remind them of where they're from, you know?
And you sell in many different places, but you one of the first places that you started selling were in farmers markets, like outside, where you're meeting people from all over the place.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that environment is just amazing. We started in September of 2010 at the New Amsterdam market specifically. By we, I mean me and a cooler full of sausages. And
no business card, right? Did you even have a business card?
Maybe we had one that I scribbled on a piece of paper. But just the difference between cooking in restaurants and doing what I was doing when I started out is immense, because you have this very direct connection to the people who are buying your food and eating it and enjoying it, and that to me was invaluable, and it really changed the way I thought about my role in food.
In what way?
I love restaurants. I grew up in them. I think in cooking. Learned so much, met so many wonderful people like Aaron, like many people that I've known over the years that are like a second family to me. But working in restaurants, as you cook, you're receding in the background, and you're not getting to have a conversation and build community with the people who are eating your food. There are rare occasions, like when you're the chef of a place, like certainly like you go out and you say what's up to people and see how everything was, and that's lovely. But like being at a market or in a retail setting where you're selling food, you can just talk to the people who are taking the food home to their families and their friends, to barbecues, giving it to their kids. Like, that to me is very impactful. Like where I'm from, it's all about like community. And I think a lot of the Brooklyn food scene is about community.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I really get that much more being at a market as opposed to in a restaurant kitchen,
which kind of ties back into the fact that you're doing this craft that you've taken that is now yours is something more old fashioned from when we lived life a different way.
No, absolutely. It's a craft that's born out of necessity and preservation, as we discussed earlier. But like the end results are just so delicious and so craveable that we still do that. We still make these things, even though we don't necessarily need to preserve this meat. It's just fantastic. Like we definitely try to pay tribute to New York City food. As a native New Yorker, I feel like I don't want that to get lost in what we do. Making pastrami, not to compete with Katz's, it's our own twist on it, but we like to think we add something to the conversation. We make our own New York style all beef hot dogs.
How do you actually make pastrami and hot dogs? Like what do you? Is there a short? Can you tell me the abbreviated version?
Yeah, absolutely. Pastrami is simple, ultimately. We start out with beef briskets. We trim them so they're not excessively fatty. We brine them in an aromatic solution of salt, brown sugar, and honey for a week. We pull them out, dry them off. We season them aggressively with a spice rub of black pepper, coriander, and a couple of other secret ingredients. And then we do slow roast in the oven for about 6 hours, and then smoke them with apple wood for 2 hours. And that's it. Done.
Pastrami.
Do it at home.
Easy. Simple. Yes. We'll do. And then a hot dog, which is very exciting.
Hot dogs are hot dogs are way trickier. Way, way trickier. We even like had a couple of snafus with some batches in the last couple of weeks. A hot dog is an emulsified sausage, essentially.
You have to make a paste, right?
Exactly.
I just pop my peas.
Exactly. Pop them. just like our hot dogs, like they pop because they're so snappy. But like,
they're in real casings.
They're in, like, everything, all the sausages we make are in natural casings, either natural hog or sheep casings. So the hot dogs are smaller in diameter than most sausages, so we use all natural lamb casings. But the entire mix is beef, and getting that right ratio of protein to fat to liquid is way more crucial when you want a texture that is like smooth and seamless, uh-huh. as opposed to something like an Italian sausage or a bratwurst that's a little bit more coarse, but you still want it to be holding together and you want it to be like tight and semi-emulsified. But in terms of hot dogs or mortadella or vice versa, like you want that texture to be completely like smooth and seamless, and it's very difficult. You have to really dial in your ratios for that and treat everything very well, make sure everything's cold.
I've had a couple, because it's funny that you can now find hot dogs made by people here more and more frequently, but many of them are bad. You know, like they have to figure out how to be like a too dry, or like it's almost like break it. And that must be the ratio of water that you're talking about, or the liquid.
It
or everything you've just described.
It could potentially be. I mean, we have trouble with it. I just would never want to serve anything like you described, but it's really not an easy thing to make. But I think fat content is pretty critical. But also, like, because if you don't have enough, you're not going to get that texture. That's super desirable. But to have everything in the proper ratio with the liquid as well, like just because something has liquid doesn't mean it's going to be necessarily juicy.
Uh-huh.
The liquid sort of acts as a binding agent, much like you're making a vinaigrette, like where the fat molecules are suspended in the water molecules when you're whisking vinegar or lemon juice into into some type of oil. So that it sort of acts as a binding agent. I'm not really like a Harold McGee style meat geek, but I do know what works. But uh-huh. like essentially those are the same principles that are at work.
So do you enjoy making something like that or as much or more than a simple lamb and olive fresh sausage? Like what appeals to you most?
That honestly, making something like a hot dog is more challenging. I think it's even more challenging than making cured meats very well, believe it or not. There's a lot of mystery surrounding cured meats. Ultimately, if you have a little bit of practice and a little bit of direction, it's not that hard. But certainly, yeah, I do think that making emulsified sausage as well, like hot dogs and vice versa and mortadella, is probably the most satisfaction that I get of doing anything in the craft, because I feel like it's so volatile, uh-huh. and it's very difficult to do well by hand.
Well, also people have such expectations for these food products that they know really, really well. Like you can make up a name for a sausage with stuff in it, and people are like, this is delicious. But like, they have a perception about what they want a hot dog or a vice versa to taste like.
No, you're absolutely right, and having those touchstones can be very challenging. Because you don't want to mess around with people's memory, you know, and their life experiences growing up, you know. So we're careful when we try to like take the vice versa in a different direction, or anything in a different direction. Like the English bangers are straightforward. The hot dogs, I think, are true to what a New York style hot dog is, with very fresh seasonings. Try not to mess around with that stuff, but people will argue with you about flavor profiles and sizes even. It's like it's hard to please everyone when there are so, and bratwurst also, like, I mean, there are probably 70 different types of bratwurst out there. It's like ridiculous.
Really?
Yeah.
You make one.
We just make one, like simple pork one with the classic German seasonings.
Wait, so what is the definition of a bratwurst?
It's just a sausage.
Just a sausage.
It's just okay. And then there are emulsified types, like that are German style. There are coarse types. There are ones with veal. There are ones with cream.
What does brat mean?
I don't know, Rachel.
I'll look that up. You can find that on the website later.
What's your best seller?
Wow. Question from the crowd.
the pastrami flies.
Not bacon?
The bacon does very well, but I feel as though like so many people are making it and there are so many options out there that it's going to get lost. You have to almost, it's good. Our bacon is really good in itself, but I think the pastrami the chicken garlic sausage. The hot dogs would sell better if we made more of them. Our pastrami, our chicken garlic sausage, and all of our lamb sausages tend to sell well. The one with black olives, the one with...
Those are really good.
Thank you. I like those ones, too. There's a new one that we're doing with charred lemons, Greek yogurt, and oregano.
Wow.
That's kind of awesome on the grill, and our merguez, too.
Like, wait, so how does that work on the grill? It doesn't, like, come out or fry off or...
No, because we use relatively a small amount that we assume into the mix after
inside
we...
inside the casing.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not like smeared on the casing or smeared inside. It's like assumed into the mix, like when we would add wine or water to a mix.
Do you work from? Do you get in whole animals and then like I'm going to use this for lamb sausage and I'm going to use that to cure into like some kind of hanging leg? And how do you approach this?
We don't get whole animals currently, and the main reason being is space, and also what the focus of what we do is. We are not a butcher shop. We don't sell steaks and we don't sell pork chops. And those, if we got whole animals in, we would be forced into that business.
Right.
And that's honestly not what I'm so interested in. I love steaks. I love pork chops. Don't get me wrong. But I'm more interested in the craft and doing these items well. So what we do is we get...
Because you wouldn't want to use those pieces of an animal for sausages or...
Absolutely not, because it wouldn't be cost effective at all. And the costs are reflective of demand more so than actual value. More people want to eat pork chops than they want to eat pork shoulder. So that's why pork chops cost more in your butcher shop. But ultimately, you're paying one price for the entire animal. And in order to be smart and utilize and to maximize each part of it and make and get value for it, you have to be in a butcher shop setting. But one of the best features, I think, of what we do, not only do we love the craft, not only do we love eating this stuff, not only do we love like sharing it, but I do think that demand for prime cuts leaves a lot of farmers with excess of chuck meat from the shoulder, which is excellent for sausage making, and also hams on a pig, like the hind leg. And that sometimes they can't sell those things to restaurants or at farmers markets as is. They do have ways in which they can make charcuterie and other value-added products, but not always. And that's a problem for them and something we enjoy helping them alleviate because not only are we getting this awesome product on our hands that's in great supply because everyone's buying up only certain parts of the animals like pork bellies and pork chops and leaving the shoulder and the hams like available, but I spaced out there.
But are you so do you how does that work? Is someone who's selling the restaurant or whoever the pork belly do you ever work with a restaurant or another buyer to just go in on the whole animal and you get what's left over they didn't need, or is it someone else doing that? Some middleman taking care of all that machination, like Heritage, for example.
Currently, we're not. We don't have a relationship like that, but because we're at these farmers markets, we do have close relationships with farmers who have the problems that I just described. New Amsterdam Market, there's Moe's Fun Farm, and those guys do mangalitsa pork, which is amazing. It's so out of control. and Mike over at Moe's Fun is like, hey, Scotty, like I have all these restaurants buying all these bellies and all these pork chops, and we have all this shoulder meat and all these hams. Like what can we do to work together? And essentially, we've come up with a way where I'll process their pork shoulders and make a mangalitsa barbecue pork sausage that both of us are selling. That's just starting to get into play. So honestly, that to me is very fulfilling because I feel like our role and the craft that we're good at is very valuable in terms of utilization and in terms of almost like getting something greater than the sum of its parts out there to people to eat, and also helping a relatively small farmer, you know?
And what's also very cool is that you are then both there at this one market on Sundays if you happen to be able to go to Manhattan. You sell side by side, the person who raises the animals that you're using, and then you're there with the finished product right next to them.
Absolutely. It's really a wonderful symbiotic relationship that I think
farmers markets are very great at promoting, and specifically at New Amsterdam, because you have so many farmers who raise and grow raw product, and then you have so many small producers that utilize this product, and that market tends to bring those people together and make these relationships happen, which is awesome. It's like so cool. It's why I'm so happy to wake up every day and do what we do.
Well, we're about to run out of time, so I'm going to take a break away from the farmers market and ask, can people actually order this stuff online? Can they find your products if they're listening from Hawaii?
If they're listening from Hawaii or anywhere else outside of New York City, the one outlet we have for shipping is opensky.com. Michael Ruhlman and Bobby Flay have both recommended packages of our products at various times, and you can find both of those things online at opensky.com.
OpenSky. And your website is brooklyncured.com.
It is, yes.
And so this has been Meet Your Maker. We've been talking to Scott Bridie of Brooklyn Cured. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.